This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time to discuss the past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, departed last night for a trip to our campus in Edstone, England, and then he'll be going on from there to Jerusalem. This is a very exciting trip that promises to yield good fruit and positive developments for this work. Well, it so happens that coinciding with this trip, there has been a flare-up of violence in what is arguably the most politically explosive piece of real estate on earth. We're talking about the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. To learn what happened and what sparked it, we will turn to our man there in that city, Brent.
Yeah, over the past couple of weeks, there's been a pretty big change as to who runs the Temple Mount. This is, again, this 38-acre compound that houses the Al-Aqsa Mosque, houses the Dome of the Rock. Its western wall is the Wailing Wall of the Jews. And so this is a really volatile area. And ever since 1967, when Israel conquered the West Bank and took it over, they allowed the Jordanians, the former owners of the East Jerusalem, including the Old City, including the Temple Mount, they allowed Jordan to continue to run the day-to-day affairs of the Muslim holy site, the Temple Mount, or Haram al-Sharif. And in that time, for the past 50 years, we have had Jordanians basically overseeing the day-to-day affairs. Well, that has now changed. We still have Jordanians as the leadership of the group, but now the 11-member group of what is known as the Waqf, or this religious trust that organized the day-to-day running of the site, has been expanded to 18 members, and it now includes 7 high Palestinian Authority officials. And that happened last Thursday, and immediately after this change, we saw this group of the Waqf, including these high Palestinian officials, including their Jerusalem affairs minister, including one of the close advisors to Mahmoud Abbas, they came to the Temple Mount and prayed at a specific location, a location that was cordoned off by Israel, and when no Palestinians were allowed to enter this area for the past, 16 years. They said, basically, we want to now enter this location. We're going to go through into this area. We're not allowed, and start praying there. And so this was their first act of Palestinian members being part of this group. And it was an act of defiance against Israeli sovereignty on the Temple Mount. Israel still controls the Temple Mount. When there's dangers, when there's flare-ups, they're going to go in there with their forces and stop it. But they will leave it alone if there's no issues. Well, now we have Palestinians on this governing group. And there are issues.
Yeah, we're talking about what seem like fairly minor developments here. The reconstitution of this trust that you're talking about, a few Muslims praying. But help us to understand why these types of moves have such tremendous symbolic significance, and that demonstrate a real determination on the part of the Palestinians to stir up trouble.
Right. So anything that happens on the Temple Mount, is especially if Israeli forces are going in there and they're arresting people for violence or something like that, it's going to be portrayed all over the Arab world as Israel trying to take over the holy site, Israel trying to take over Al-Aqsa. And this was portrayed in this way as well. But what happened after this initial prayer session was Israel was going to call one of the members of the governance group for questioning. Then Jordan got involved and said, please don't do that. It's going to set off a storm. And so Israel said, fine, we'll just let him go. And so Israel came to this area. It's right by the Golden Gate. This is on the eastern side of the Temple Mount. It's nowhere near Al-Aqsa Mosque itself. This is a gate that actually is sealed off. It's been sealed off for 400 years. Nobody can enter the Temple Mount through this gate. But adjacent to this gate is an area that was used back in 2003 by this Heritage Foundation. Basically, they were illegally excavating, destroying antiquities. They had connections with Hamas, and that's why Israel closed this area. And so you have this group going in, praying. Jordan coming in, saying, please don't interrogate them. So Israel comes back on Sunday night. This is a week ago. Puts a little lock on the gate and says, don't go in this area from the inside. And then the next day, you have Palestinians show up. They start beating down on the gate, breaking the lock, and going in there and praying. Israel arrests some of them. And then you have the next day, Israel puts a new gate up, puts a new lock on it. Jordan intervenes and says, hey, can you please take that down? The Arab world is going to get so upset because you're putting a lock on a gate on the Temple Mount. Uh-huh. So Israel takes the lock down off this gate. The next day, there's still people that are going to this area trying to pray. Praying, obviously, they know it's going to incur a physical response. So Israel is there arresting people because of this. And so it's getting out of hand. I mean, this already today, there were 60 arrests. Israel intelligence arrested 60 people because they knew after Friday prayers today that there was going to be another dust up, that people wanted to use this as an excuse for having more violence against or use this as an excuse to fight against the Israelis, and also to show the world that, as they see it, that Israel is trying to stop their prayers on the Temple Mount. Right. They haven't prayed in this location for the past 15 years.
Right.
But it's all about how it is portrayed.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm reminded of the incident in, was it the summer of 2017, where there was some provocation on the part of the Palestinians. The Israelis responded by installing metal detectors and security cameras, and it created such a kerfuffle among the Palestinians that eventually the Israelis said, okay, fine, we'll take these down. Even just these basic rudimentary security measures that they couldn't do because of how much opposition they faced for it. And it seems like every time, here in this case, Israel finally says, fine, we won't put a lock on the gate. You know, they're backing down. They're conceding to this pressure on the part of these Palestinians. You know that it's not an effective and sustainable strategy in the long run.
Yeah, and it's not going to end. I mean, people are looking back at what happened in 2017 as the reason that the Palestinians are doing this past week. They know that Israel will back down if given enough pressure.
Right.
If the Palestinians don't back down, Israel will. Now, remember back in 2017, this wasn't just a minor incident. Two people were killed because Palestinians were hiding machine guns inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And so Israel said, well, if you're going to do that, then we need to set up metal detectors to make sure none of those high-powered weaponries get on the Temple Mount. And there was that week-long protest, and everybody was getting involved. There was riots everywhere over Jerusalem. More people were killed over this because Israel apparently was trying to stop worship on the Temple Mount. That's not true. But it's all about how it is portrayed. And the thing that stopped, the reason that Israel took down their metal detectors last time and they took away their surveillance cameras last time was because they were worried that it was going to get so out of hand and there were going to be outside forces such as Iran that were going to use this excuse to gain more control over the Palestinian cause. If the Palestinians aren't going to stand up for themselves, that is the Palestinian leadership, then we'll come in, Iran will, and we'll lead this revolt. And the everyday Palestinians jumped on board. And so Israel backed down. The Palestinian Authority wanted Israel to back down because they were worried about Iran going in. The Jordanians, who were in control of the Temple Mount, they wanted Israel to back down because of whatever Iran was doing. Jordan fears Iran just as much as Israel does. And so with this situation, since Israel backed down last time, I think we're going to see more riots. They will continue until Israel backs down again, especially because we have an election coming up in April and the prime minister won't do anything right now to upset his chances at winning that.
Put it in prophetic context for us. Temple Mount prophecy is so crucial.
Yeah, the Temple Mount, as we said, is the most volatile place in the entire world. It doesn't matter. Truth does not matter on the Temple Mount. It is all about what the perception of Israel aggression on the Temple Mount, stopping Muslims from being allowed to pray at their third holiest site, and the Arab world goes crazy. And the Bible talks about how there is going to be a Temple Mount impasse where a situation like this could erupt, and there is going to be mass mobilization of Palestinians to try and secure Temple Mount sovereignty for themselves. And that's what we see with this change of the Palestinian group now, part of this decision-making body. Sovereignty of the Temple Mount is changing slowly. Now, the Bible says that one of the critical precursors to end-time events, or really the first domino to fall, is half of Jerusalem falling to the Palestinians. Well, what is going to motivate the Palestinians to rise up in an armed uprising against the Israelis, but an uprising over the Temple Mount? The first intifada was an uprising over the Temple Mount. The second intifada was an uprising over the Temple Mount. The third intifada is going to be the same, but eventually this type of uprising will lead to half of Jerusalem falling into Palestinian hands. And the Bible puts that as that first domino to fall, where we can really start to see end time prophetic events coalescing that will lead to the return of Jesus Christ. Basically, it's one of those dominoes that points to that sign.
Yeah, it is. You just never know what the exact event is going to trigger that chain reaction. We focus on it so closely because those prophecies are so specific, and it really does revolve around that particular area. And so it is just something that we have to watch very closely. It could blow over in a few days, or it could, as you said, one thing lead to another. And we're very aware of, you know, here we have Gerald Flory going into that very area here within just a few days. We're very focused. Our attention is very focused on that area, and to see how this might unfold over the next few days will be very interesting to watch. You can read more about that specific prophecy in our booklet by Gerald Flory, Jerusalem and Prophecy. Brent also has an article up at the Watch Jerusalem website, Palestinians Gain More Control on the Temple Mount. Go to Watch Jerusalem. Go to that website. A lot of very high-quality coverage of the recent events in Israel, and you can keep your eye on what's happening in the news over there, as well as in archaeology and history. It's just a wonderful resource that we have as a sister website to thetrumpet.com. Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. A very intriguing statement coming from a former republic of the Soviet Union. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said on February 15th that his country is prepared to merge with Russia. These comments came at the end of a meeting Lukashenko had with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And Lukashenko said, quote, "The two of us could unite tomorrow, no problem. We're ready to unite and consolidate our efforts, states, and peoples," end quote. Now, it is true that Lukashenko has built a reputation over the years of kind of skillfully resisting pressure from Russia, partly by, you know, deploying statements like this that sound conciliatory but are ultimately mostly empty. And his remarks did also include kind of a caveat. He said this merging of Belarus into Russia would only happen if the Belarusian people are, quote, ready for it, which is something that both sides know presently is not the case. But Lukashenko's remarks still deserve a lot of attention, because in a world of rising authoritarianism, the will of the people, and whatever they may or may not be ready for, matters less and less. the world is becoming a lot more authoritarian. We see strong men coming to power and becoming more powerful in several nations. And Putin is really the most powerful of all of them, especially when you consider those nuclear arsenals that he controls. Putin has a tight grip on Russia, as we know, but he also has a considerable grip on Lukashenko and on Belarus. So if he was determined to make a merger like this happen, that would be far more important than the will of the people. And Putin also has some really good reasons to want to bring Belarus officially under his control. And I think Lukashenko's statements could suggest that Putin might have decided that he'll soon act on some of those reasons.
So what is Putin after, I guess, what's motivating him to try to merge Belarus into Russia?
Well, I think the first reason is just his general desire to rebuild the Soviet Union. You know, Putin called the collapse of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. It's no secret that he longs to rebuild it. And Belarus, as you mentioned in the introduction, used to be a part of that union, just like Georgia, Ukraine, and 11 other nations. Now, we've already seen Putin's Russia invade Georgia 10 years ago, bringing a fifth of Georgia back under Russia's control, just like the whole country had been under Russia's control in the Soviet era. We've also seen Putin's Russia invade Ukraine and bring a lot of that country back under Russia's control. So Belarus has stayed very tightly aligned with Russia, more so than any other nation in the post-Soviet era, and making it a part of Russia would really further Putin's quest of rebuilding that union. So that's one reason. And then another big one is just because Putin's popularity rating and his trust rating have been sharply falling in the last few months. His trust rating is down to its lowest level in 13 years right now. And in the past, when he's led Russia in these, you know, aggressive forays of foreign policy, those ratings have just soared in response. The Russians are very proud. They're often very nationalistic. They love to see Putin making Russia great again, so to speak. And every time he's done something like that with Georgia or Ukraine, the people have rallied behind him with amazing enthusiasm. And Putin knows this. So if his numbers keep on falling, he may calculate that the best way to sort of boost them back up would be to integrate Belarus into Russia. And then the last reason I'll mention is just that Putin is supposed to be leaving the Russian presidency in a few years when his current term ends because of constitutional limits. It is true that in the past he's found a crafty way to sidestep the constitutional limits, so he might do that again, or he might just change the constitution. But both of those options would be very politically risky, especially with how unpopular he's become recently. And with Belarus, there's another very good option available. If Belarus merges into Russia, it would create basically a new political entity. Russia-Belarus union would be almost like a new country. They've already got a treaty written up that would make it create kind of a new country that includes those two countries. So
then they say, well, let's see, who should be the leader of this new country?
Exactly. Yes, and Putin could, of course, become ruler and imbue it with real power. He could make his office at the head of that union more powerful than whomever may succeed him as the Russian president. And that way he keeps his power, actually, you know, boosts it, all without having to change the constitution.
So the all of this seems to fit, or it could very well, the way that it unfolds, fit with what Gerald Fleury has been talking about with respect to the Russian leader.
Yes, that's right. Bible prophecy talks about the role of Russia's leader in end time events. Revelation 9:16 talks about a huge Asian army that'll be a major player in nuclear World War III. With 200 million soldiers, it'll be the largest army by many orders of magnitude that the world has ever seen. And Ezekiel 38:2 says a prince of Rosh, or Russia, will be the man leading this huge force. And Trumpet editor-in-chief in the Trumpet's September 2014 issue, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has identified exactly who this Russian prince is. He wrote, quote, "I strongly believe Vladimir Putin is going to lead the 200 million-man army. I can see no one else on the horizon who could do that. This much is absolutely certain. The restoring of Russia's power by Putin, the Prince of Russia, was prophesied." And then in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Fleury shows that parts of this Prince of Rosh prophecy have already been fulfilled by Putin, and he says that he thinks Putin will stay in power to fulfill even more of it. So whether Putin retains power by coming the head of a Russia-Belarus union, or whether he amends or sidesteps the Constitution, or whether the world descends into chaos before that question becomes pressing, the Trumpet believes that he will be the main power over Russia during that most chaotic period of mankind's history. So these prophecies and developments, they sound alarming, and they really should sober us. But Mr. Fleury also shows that this is not all bad news. You know, Brent just mentioned the dominoes leading up to Christ's return. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Fleury has really pointed to Vladimir Putin as another of those. We don't necessarily know all the exact order of everything, but he said in the prophesied Prince of Russia, he writes, Mr. Putin's warfare is going to lead directly into the second coming of Christ. Vladimir Putin is a sign, literally a sign, that Jesus Christ is about to return. This is one of the most inspiring messages in the Bible. What we are seeing in Russia ultimately leads to the transition from man ruling man to God ruling man. Surely we ought to be studying our Bibles and understanding these prophecies.
Yeah, very good. Well, you can read that booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, by going to the literature tab on thetrumpet.com. And also, Jeremiah wrote about this in his Trumpet Brief on Wednesday. The Trumpet Brief is that daily email brief that we send out to subscribers. He sent it out on Wednesday, and that article is now posted to thetrumpet.com. The title, Russia to Absorb Belarus, We're Ready to Unite, Lukashenko says. So go check that out at thetrumpet.com, and thank you for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Our new Trumpet edition went off to press last night. This is our April 2019 edition. It's a very powerful issue. We have a terrific cover story from Brad McDonald and Josue Michels about Germany's remarkable industrial capacity and how this is going to contribute to its rise as a military superpower. This will all be going up on the website next week. You can watch for that. We also have an article in this issue from Stephen Fleury about the Aachen Treaty, the friendship agreement just inked between Germany and France. And some information came out this week about a secret clause that was part of that agreement. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, yeah, Spiegel Online is reporting that as this treaty was being negotiated, Germany and France signed a secret pact, and then that pact, the Aachen Treaty, was later made conditional on this secret pact. And this secret pact, I think, really it makes clear how serious France is about making certain, and Germany, certain parts of this treaty more than just a symbolic gesture and something very practical. Now, one of the big parts of the Aachen Treaty is that these two countries really want to work together on defense. They want to work together building new weapon systems. Even in around the same time as the treaty was produced, a little bit after the treaty, there was a big announcement that the two of them were going to work together on a new fighter jet. They didn't want to buy America's F-35. They wanted to come up with their own. So they really want to focus on this. In the past, there's always been a huge obstacle, though. Whenever they make fighting equipment, France wants to sell it just about anywhere that they can. Meanwhile, Germany, because of its history and because of some of those conditions in its constitution after World War II, has got to be more selective about where it sells its equipment. And this is part of where all these joint arms projects come undone. France tries to sell it to somewhere, but then Germany says, well, actually, the half of that airplane that's made in France, you can't sell to the... I mean, that's made in Germany, you can't sell to that country. Hmm. And it all comes apart. So in the run-up to this Aachen Treaty, they came up with this secret agreement that stipulates that neither side can block the export of jointly developed weapon systems. So from now on, Germany can't say, no, the half of our plane can't be sold to Saudi Arabia. So it makes their combined arms projects much more plausible, much more functional. And also it makes a dramatic weakening of the restrictions that have been on Germany's weapons exports overseas, and makes it much harder for Germany to restrict these weapons exports. It's great for Germany in a lot of ways, because there's always been this dynamic where the German government has wanted to sell weapons to some of these places, like Saudi Arabia, for example, but it's been very unpopular at home, and they've often bowed to popular pressure. Now, they can say, well, yeah, people at home that don't want us to sell to this country, we understand, but there's nothing we can do. We've got to agree because we're in this joint treaty with France. And then
way that you're describing this, it's one of these Germany being able to do what it has wanted to do, but doing it under the cloak of this joint agreement where they have a certain amount of cover.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Yeah.
I just think it's interesting that just to have a proven example of in this day and age, countries signing secret treaties with each other. And, you know, okay, well, this is one secret part of the Aachen Treaty that's come out. Are there other parts? What is going on? You know, if Germany and France are doing some of this backdoors behind the scenes negotiation, well, that in itself, regardless of the content of that negotiation, is really interesting as well.
Well, yeah. How did the information come out? It's only been a couple of weeks since the treaty was made. It's not all that secret, it seems to me, and it seems like this does reflect the seriousness of these two nations to work together to align militarily. Is some of those takeaways that we got from the treaty, it seems like this just underlines that.
Right. I don't know exactly how it got out. I think it was a Spiegel exclusive, and obviously, you know, they're a big and long-standing news magazine, and so, you know, somebody leaked for them, probably someone from the left. They're still part of Merkel's coalition government, and they tend to be anti-arms sales, so they probably weren't too keen on this getting out. But it really does. It's right in line with exactly the trend that we've been watching and talking about with this Franco-German cooperation. I mean, we've gone back a few times to this cover article from the February 2019 edition of the Trumpet article from Mr. Gerald Fleury. The cover says Macron versus Trump. The article title is France Rejects America and Empowers Germany. And it's about how significant this relationship is. And in that article, there's a pretty substantial section where he talks about the various different combined arms programs, where the two of them are working together on these different military projects. And so then to see them with this Aachen Treaty, to see them, you know, not just getting closer together, but then having this new seriousness on arms projects and replacing the United States and reliance on American weapons, it really just underscores everything that he said in that article.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing, this, I really do want to encourage listeners to check out this new Trumpet issue. We have this very lengthy article by Brad McDonald and Josue Michels, and the infographic that talks about this Germany's industrial might. It is our cover story for this next issue, and just how effective Germany has been in using arms exports in order to preserve and enlarge its industrial capacity, to perfect its weapons, in spite of not keeping a lot of them at home and having a fairly hollowed out military for quite some time, it has built the means by which it would be able to empower itself dramatically in a very short amount of time. And it seems these arrangements that they made with the French just make it even easier for them to continue in that vein. So do check that out. Watch for that. It'll be up online next week, the April 2019 Trumpet edition. We appreciate that, Richard. We're going to go over to the U.S. now. President Donald Trump's efforts to build a wall on America's southern border, despite all the evidence of just how costly and dangerous illegal immigration is, this effort is running into remarkable opposition. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
They've been working for some time to come up with a way to get a wall on the southern border. That was President Trump's, one of his, actually in many ways, his signature campaign promise. Now, after a couple years into his administration, they still haven't been able to get Congress to pass a bill. And so President Trump took a unique approach by declaring a national emergency. It's kind of like an executive order where he said if it's like under period of national threat, if you're under threat from illegal immigrants or drug cartels, that we need this wall for national protection. And by doing so, he's able to allocate $1.3 billion for a 55-mile border fence. So definitely not the huge Great Wall of China going 2,000 miles along the Mexican border that many people envisioned during the campaign. And but it's a start, and it's something that is coming under quite a bit of scrutiny, though, with I think 16 states have challenged this for whether that's legal or not. I'm not familiar with the very intricacies of that legal thing, but as with most things in Washington, there's definitely going to be a fight over it. But as we've mentioned on this program many times before, there are this is very prophetic in that there's specific prophecies, one we've mentioned a few times in Isaiah 5:5, that likens the United States or end time Israel to a hedged vineyard. That God says, he said, I will tell you what I'll do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up. I will break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. And then later on, it talks about, like I said, this vineyard's an analogy for Israel. And in Herbert W. Armstrong's classic book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, which we can put in the show notes, it explains how the United States is the end-time descendants of Israel. And it has been hedged, but that hedge is going to be breaking down, so those outside the hedge can come in and eat things up. Another verse that we've mentioned on this program quite a bit is Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52 that talks about, again, Israel. But it says, you shall be besieged in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down wherein you trusted. This is pointing out too that, like, anti-Israel, they're going to have more trust in the wall than in God, and so even the walls start coming down. And there's been a one point Mr. Trump made about this being a national emergency, despite the legal the legal back and forth over it, is valid. They had a one a special security agent from the Federal Drug Agency making a point that he says, so we're arguing about the wrong thing here. It's not the product that matters. It's not the drug product that matters. The product doesn't sell itself or produce itself. It's the people who make the cartel run, collect the cash, do the distribution, engage in violence, and run operations for the cartel. The people who are operating the networks are all illegal immigrants, and they're not coming in at the checkpoints. And so you're saying that there's quite a bit of discrepancy as to over how many illegal immigrants are coming in here. But this is a person in the Drug Administration Agency. He said, like, all the distribution networks are run by people coming in places where there should be a wall.
Yeah, I marvel at the fact that this is a point of contention in the United States. It seems like those who are resisting the idea of actually having a barrier when you have so many problems that are coming as a result of these open borders are purely political. There's a very a lot of it is resistance to Donald Trump personally, it seems to me. A lot of it is the Democratic Party that seems to be so intent on increasing the amount of immigration as a means of increasing their political power. You have to see a lot of cynicism in the kinds of choices that people are making in order to turn this into the kind of battle that it is. It seems like it would be something that would be apparently is among a whole lot of Americans a point of unanimity, that this is something we can all agree on. We need to secure our borders. And I think Donald Trump has done a good job of even pointing back to many of the statements that Democratic leaders were making not too long ago, where they were saying we absolutely need this kind of a wall. Now they're directly contradicting that, again, purely for political purposes. But the opposition that's taking place, the battle, the argument, the contention that's taking place over this right now in the United States, it just seems emblematic of a tremendous political divide that has seized America.
Right. Yeah. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of reasons why a lot of important politicians and security officials don't want to crack down on illegal immigration. You mentioned about the voting angle is that a lot of illegal immigrants, once they get amnesty or if they vote illegally, that does benefit the Democratic Party tremendously by having a new voter base from Latin America. There's also the cheap labor thing where there's a lot of that goes on, especially in California, where they talk a big talk about the $15 minimum wage, but then flood their country where, like, with illegal immigrants that they can pay next to nothing. And then there's even the drug angle I brought up. I mean, there's a lot of judges and politicians who want their cocaine fix, and like that drug agency said, mentioned, it is the illegal immigrants doing the distribution work for the cartels. So if you don't really want to crack down on the drug flow, you do need a certain amount of illegal immigration coming in for the logistics purposes there. But the divide is amazing. And as I said, neither side is completely right. As I mentioned earlier about that verse about the trusting in the wall more than trusting God. So you're saying, so there's a flaw amongst the conservatives, as many of them, who are putting more faith in this wall than God. But then on the other side, you've got to the point where this Deuteronomy 28 is listing this as a curse, that he said, if you don't trust God, your wall is going to come down. And so it's like a curse on the conservatives, but for the, the liberal or open border immigration, it's like you've got this weird thing where you actually like desire the curse.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, the conservatives are going to get this curse of the wall coming down, whether they want it or not. Where the other side, they're actually wanting what God said is bad for a nation.
It's a terrible situation, and you just can't see this having any positive resolution the way that it's unfolding now. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a prophetically important summit between Arab states and the European Union, China strengthening its grip on a nation in East Africa, and more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
One prophecy we watch closely is found in the book of Psalms, not typically thought of as a prophetic book, but there is a lot of prophecy in that book, and perhaps none is more specific than the one found in Psalm 83. It is an end-time forecast of an alliance between several Arab states and Germany. So we watch closely for evidence of that, and there is more and more to be found. To learn about the latest, we will go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
This coming Sunday, European leaders are going to meet with a lot of members of the Arab League down in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh, and this is the first summit that they're having together. Basically, a lot of leaders from the 28-member bloc of the EU coming down there. The German leader, Angela Merkel, is going to be there. British Prime Minister Theresa May is going to be there. The Irish Prime Minister. There will also be a bunch of Arab leaders that are going to meet. This meeting is the first of its kind. While we have had, obviously, Europeans meet with Arabs before, this is the first time where we're going to see a European-led delegation come down there to discuss these many different troubling issues that they face, be them the mass immigration of Arabs and others through Syria and Libya. They could also be talking about Iran and the dangers of Islamic terrorism. And they're obviously also going to be talking a lot about the economic benefits that they can each bring to the table. And so what's interesting about this, and I'm so happy that you just brought the prophecy in straight away, is the fact that the Bible speaks of a growing alliance between Europe, led by Germany specifically, and a lot of the states that are going to be meeting down in Egypt over this weekend.
Yeah, it's. We were just talking about the summit that the United States and Poland sponsored, and there were some prominent European leaders who were not there. You made the point that it's not because they don't have a vested interest in aligning with these Arab nations, but here we see evidence of them having direct diplomacy with some of the very states that, that we were talking about.
Yeah, and I think that that's just so... in a way, it's quite funny that the European leaders bag on the United States for organizing a summit basically such as they have organized. And now they're going to do their turn or have their turn with these Arab states. Now, it doesn't look like Iran necessarily is going to be the topic number one, just because you have so much disagreement within the EU right now. I think actually this is going to be not very successful, this meeting, just because you still have 28 members in Europe trying to find their way through these a muddle of issues. And even this article I was reading in Arab News, this is a Saudi paper, it talks about how when we talks about migration and the issues that Europe is facing through its southern borders, from migration through Africa and other places in the Middle East, they are all divided on this. And so until Europe can speak with one unified voice, that's what Arab News said, not me, it's difficult to see how they are going to move forward. Well, Bible prophecy talks about both of those things happening. It talks about, one, that there will be a growing alliance out of necessity at Europe's southern border, and even this term alliance is used in this article, with these Arab states, and there will be it will be led by a single voice from Europe. And so maybe just them going down there trying to hash out something, they Europe recognizes they need the moderate Arab states on their side, and they need to work with them and grow in a structured alliance with them. But maybe this is going to push them to see that, well, they need to unify themselves before it's going to have an effect.
Yeah, excellent point. You could see this really as, if nothing more, evidence of just how great the need is that Europe is recognizing. They must find more alignment with these Arab states in order to address some of these rising concerns. And yet, whether or not that happens or the degree to which it happens this weekend, we would expect that the alignment between several of those states specifically mentioned in that prophecy in Psalm 83 and Germany in particular would increase in the time ahead. For more information, where would you send people, Brent?
I think you can just go ahead and read our trend article on this prophecy. It's at thetrumpet.com, and it's entitled An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe.
Thank you for that, Brent. U.S. President Donald Trump is not a popular man in Europe. Nevertheless, this past week he received a visit from one very popular head of state in Europe. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Sebastian Kurz, the Austrian Wunderkind, the leader of Austria that's come in the last year or so, he traveled to Washington. And a lot of people were very curious about this visit because on the surface, there's a lot of things that Mr. Kurz and Mr. Trump have in common. They've both risen to power on an anti-immigration platform and about protecting the nation's borders. They're both kind of pretty right wing. They've both kind of run as political outsiders to a certain extent. And so people were saying, well, yeah, a lot of different European leaders have had trouble getting on with Mr. Trump. Well, let's see how Sebastian Kurz does. Maybe he'll be a kind of more of a kindred spirit. And that's not what happened. And this is really a continuation of what we were talking about on Wednesday's show with this this Euro-American split. But here's what the EU Observer wrote about this visit. They wrote, the current rift in transatlantic relations seems to be deepening by the day. The visit of the Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz to the White House on Wednesday, the first such summit in 13 years, only underlines this even further. And this is despite the fact that Trump and Kurz share a common conservative agenda and a number of foreign policy goals. Now, a lot of this particular dispute with Mr. Kurz boils around a trade war that is potentially brewing between the United States and the European Union right now. Mr. Trump has had the domestic groundwork laid to be able to put tariffs on European cars. And this is something, well, it's a huge concern to Germany, but then so much of Europe just supplies parts for the German economy, and Austria fits in with that pattern fairly well. So he was very concerned about this particular trade agreement that's brewing. But it was certainly a frosty reception, and one, you know, that was more frosty than a lot of people expected.
So tell us a bit more. Maybe you could just remind us what Mr. Fleury has said about Sebastian Kurz and how he fits in with a broader trend within Europe.
Yes, the person of the fact that this is Sebastian Kurz is why I think this is especially worth watching. Again, going, this was back in the September 2019, or also the October 2018 Trumpet print edition, with the Holy Roman Empire is back on the cover. Mr. Fleury talked about Sebastian Kurz and the way that he's brought the Catholic Church, and he's pretty close to Cardinal Schönborn, he's into the government more. He's saying he's using more and more of kind of like Christian principles to determine what he's doing, taking advice from senior Catholics. And he's also really brought back a lot of the history of the Holy Roman Empire, talking about Charlemagne's heritage, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburgs. When you put those two trends together of somebody bringing religion into politics and talking about those other leaders in the past a lot that also brought religion into politics, you know, he really looks like he's taking Europe in the direction that the Bible says it's going to go. So Mr. Fleury highlighted Mr. Kurz and his politics, what he's doing, and really pointed that he could be the part of the future of Europe. And then you also look at another individual that we're very closely watching, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, as a potential strongman of Germany. He's good friends with Sebastian Kurz, and he's said some very supportive things about him. And so to see, you know, the man that one of the people that we're looking at is, you know, this is a good indication of the future of Europe, coming and then having this frosty relationship with Mr. Trump, it really does give you an example of where Europe's going. It's not a case of, say, left-wing Macron disagreeing with Donald Trump, or kind of the Angela Merkel being a bit pro-immigrant and wishy-washy disagreeing with Mr. Trump. You know, even this more kind of hard right rising Europe disagrees with Mr. Trump. And you see that in zu Guttenberg as well, where he's been incredibly dismissive, even insulting, well, definitely insulting of Mr. Trump and what he's talked about. So you see this growing divide and animosity to America just across all parts of Europe.
Well, we do have an article online from Stephen Fleury from last week, the Trumpet executive editor, The Return of Anti-Americanism in Germany, that puts this frostiness that Richard is talking about in its larger context. And also do take a look at that article from Gerald Fleury, The Holy Roman Empire is Back, explaining Kurz's position within Austria and the role that he's playing in the revival of the Holy Roman Empire history in Europe. Thank you very much for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. China's efforts to extend its influence throughout the world continues, with moves to tighten its grip on a strategic part of East Africa. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China has now asserted full control over a strategic container terminal in the East African nation of Djibouti. The Chinese are asserting this control through a government-run company called China Merchant Port Holdings. And a Wall Street Journal report on Thursday said the company has now fully taken over operations at Djibouti's Dorella container terminal. And the location of this, it's, you know, it's right at the entrance to the Red Sea, right at the junction there where the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea meet at the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. And it would be hard to overstate just how geostrategically important the location of this country and this terminal are. The Dorella Container Terminal is actually the only port in the whole region that can handle and house and exchange cargo between ships. So this terminal is the only way to get seaborne cargo into East Africa. It's really a gateway into the whole, you know, continent right there. So that makes it very important. And then whoever controls this area could also potentially shut down the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, an incredibly important sea gate that about 12% of total seaborne trade passes through. So China's moves here really represents a major boost to Chinese power.
You kind of alluded to it, but maybe you could just talk about the threat to American interests that this poses.
Yes. Well, America has only one permanent military base in all of Africa, and that is Camp Le Monnier in Djibouti. Camp Le Monnier is actually only about 5 miles from Durella Container Terminal, this terminal that China's taking over. And the U.S. is entirely dependent on Durella Container Terminal for bringing cargo into Camp Le Monnier. You know, all of America's supplies come through that port. So this Chinese takeover really places the U.S. in a tight spot there. But so far, the U.S. doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. An official with DP World said all supplies for the U.S. base come through the port, and if it falls into Chinese hands, there could be significant problems. We are baffled by the U.S. inaction. End quote. So some people see this happening. They're baffled by just how China's taking full control over it. The U.S. isn't doing anything. But if you know about Bible prophecy, that really shouldn't be that baffling. Bible prophecy talks about the times of the Gentiles happening shortly before the return of Jesus Christ. Christ himself talked about that in Luke 21:24. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Mr. Gerald Flurry has written quite a lot about these times of the Gentiles. And this he said that one of the two main Gentile power blocks that rise up in the end time it'll have Russia and China at its center. So this situation in Djibouti, with China taking over the gateway into East Africa, and in this area that's so important to global trade, and, you know, doing it all in a way that poses a real threat to America's presence, it really is setting the stage for the world to move further into these times of the Gentiles.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that article from Gerald Flurry, What Are the Times of the Gentiles, in the show notes for the program today. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. One last story. Unrest is seizing the Caribbean nation of Haiti. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is one of those news stories that doesn't get a ton of coverage, even though it's tremendously geostrategically significant, similar to the last story. But you've got the island of Haiti in the Caribbean, right next to the island of Cuba, with a ocean shipping passage, the Windward Passage, in between the two islands. They've been having protests there. They're trying to get rid of their president on charges of corruption. But in addition to the corruption, the president's also seen as an American ally, which is a sore point because Haiti gets a lot of oil from Venezuela. The United States has sanctions on Venezuela right now, which has affected the Haitian economy. And so those two crises are kind of getting lumped together, where now you've got last Friday, you've got about 200 Haitians in the capital city burning American flags, chanting, "Down with Americans, long live Putin." And these protesters, they're calling for Russia, China, and Venezuela to get more involved in the island's economy, trying to combat inflation and things like that. We've got an article that's going up online explaining this, but it really highlights actually those same two verses I talked about in the last story with the national emergency, the Isaiah 5:5, "I'm going to break the hedge," the Deuteronomy 28:52. The high and fenced walls come down, and you're going to be besieged in all your gates. That Windward Passage that goes between Cuba and Haiti is the main ocean route that connects the east coast of the United States with the Panama Canal. Any boats from Virginia, Maine, Carolinas, they all come down there between Haiti and Cuba to the Panama Canal and into the Pacific Ocean. And so that's a trade gate. It's a gate. The trade that goes from America's east coast to America's west coast goes through this oceanic gate. And there's this prophecy about enemies besieging you in all your gates. And so the fact that the people from Haiti are calling for the oust of Americans and for other foreign powers to take over is just like a shot across the bow of that warning time when America loses control of the Windward Passage and the other Panama Canal and other strategic sea gates in the Caribbean region.
All right. That will do it. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Real pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Alexander Pope. He who tells a lie is not sensible of how great a task he undertakes, for he must be forced to invent 20 more to maintain that one. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.